Welcome to Sanity, a podcast by the New York Sun. My name is A.R. Hoffman, and every week my co-host Rebecca Sugar and I will try to make sense out of the nonsense and bring some sanity to your week. Just as a reminder, our Sanity interview this week with Yordana Schwartz, author of an amazing new book about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and the Hebron massacres of 1929, will appear on Sunday. And so look forward to that. And today, Rebecca, it's sort of a fun, newsy Thursday, and all of you will be listening to us on Friday, but we were just, to give you a little bit of color, we were just sort of, you know, waiting, as people have for thousands of years, to see who was going to be named the next pope. Yes. So maybe not on their smartphones, but right. we were watching St. Peter's Square, and we actually, Habemus Papam, we have a pope, and we'll talk about that in our top story. Our Make It Make Sense segment this week will be about civil rights law and Trump's policy towards DEI and the use of race, the really kind of meaty and very hot topic, really, I think, at the core of Trump's presidency in many ways. Then we're going to go to our tipping point segment, which is going to be very New York centric. It's going to be the crazy Monday night where we had the Diddy trial, the Met Gala. You can really throw in the Harvey Weinstein trial, which has been going on here in Manhattan. So we'll dive into pop culture a little bit. Although I don't, Rebecca's always dressed extraordinarily well. She could get into the Met Gala. I'm not sure
wouldn't want to go.
But she really didn't. She wouldn't go. It's like the Woody Allen. She wouldn't go if they had her, kind of thing. And then we'll get to our sunburns, and that'll be that. So, Rebecca,
I'm stopping you before you jump in, because
please.
The quote of the week.
Quote of the week. Go ahead.
The most important
part of
the podcast you almost overlooked. And it's from a movie that I hope you're old enough to have seen, Airplane.
Yes,
1980, an American classic. Steve McCroskey is an air traffic controller. And so this is a nod to our events at Newark Airport this week. Steve McCroskey was played by Lloyd Bridges, and he's an air traffic controller trying to help land the plane that doesn't have a flight crew that's functioning. And he says, "Looks like I picked the wrong week to quit sniffing glue." And I thought of that as I listened to the audio of all the air traffic controllers trying to deal with lost radar at Newark this week. Yeah. So I'll get to that later in my sunburn.
Yeah. I mean, you never really want to be at Newark Airport, let alone
nor do you want to sniff glue.
You definitely don't want to.
But
and
sometimes
you don't want to
sniff
glue
like
if you have to be at Newark Airport.
That might be the only place where anyone would understand why you were sniffing glue.
Good alibi. All right. So we have a new pope. His secular name is Robert Prevost. We might learn better how to pronounce it in the days ahead. We're just now taking in the news. He'll be known most importantly as Pope Leo XIV. And he's a Chicagoan. He's an American. Never had there been an American pope before. Remember, Francis was the first South American, and now we have an American pope.
Right.
What do you think? Well, we were talking off camera a little bit, Rebecca. And it's sort of like, Rebecca was like, does it really make a big difference or not?
That he's American, like as an American, mm-hmm. And if you're not Catholic, it has another layer of meaning. But if you're an American who's not Catholic, does this matter that he is American? What's the extra meaning for you as an American?
Yeah. Well, I think I had written a series in the Sun of kind of the Conclave Chronicles, sort of. Of course, I missed the big one, which is that it might be an American. I said, what if it's an African pope? What if it's an Asian pope? It's none of those. It's an American pope.
We've all been so DEI saturated that we just were thinking for political reasons, it had to be from one of these countries where the Catholic population is growing and has been underrepresented.
Yeah.
Never dawned on us it could be an American.
Yeah. Well, I think there are a couple of kind of ways to go here, Rebecca. I think one is, and not to make everything about Trump, but there's just no way when these cardinals huddled in the Sistine Chapel, they weren't thinking about American politics, and they chose an American. There's just no way. Remember, J.D. Vance had clashed with Pope Francis. President Trump had clashed with Pope Francis. And so I wonder if there's a kind of way of saying, okay, we need a guy on the path of the Pope who is invested in that conversation, who speaks with an American accent in a way that Francis never really spoke English, right? He spoke obviously more languages than I ever will, but English was not one of right. them. And I wonder, you know, this is an American who spent decades in Peru as a missionary. So in some ways, I wonder if they say, okay, we kind of get two for the price of one. We get an American, but someone who does have experience abroad,
yeah.
right? Experience
yeah.
in the developing world. I would have loved Cardinal Dolan to be the next pope.
Yeah.
But the other thing to say about this pope is he's only 69.
Right.
And historically, the cardinals have not loved picking young popes because that gives them a long papacy. And remember, cardinals can only vote until they're 80. Then they're put out to pasture.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So if you have a long papacy, chances are meant for many of these cardinals, they won't get to vote on another
right.
pope.
Right. Maybe Donald Trump will still be president by then.
I was just going to say, it'll be Trump's fourth term and Pope Leo XIV.
I think everything
will
about
still
this
be
screams Trump, doesn't it? Yeah. And maybe not for the lofty reasons that you're thinking. I just thought, my first thought actually was that AI image of Trump as the Pope was probably yeah. stuck in the cardinals' heads before they sequestered, and they yeah. just maybe they just by default, yeah. like they didn't even know yeah. that they were being yeah.
you know,
triggered.
The funny
but
thing
they...
about that, I was going to write a piece about, didn't get to it, is that. You know, a pope doesn't have to be a cardinal. Theoretically, you know, anyone could be a pope, but you
could have been
yeah,
Trump. Is
yeah,
that what
you
saying?
Have to be Catholic, though.
Uh-oh.
But that can be fixed, right?
Yeah.
I mean,
feels
so,
like there's a path to that.
Yeah, I mean, the other thing to say is you know, the future of the church really isn't in America. I mean, there are some trends that show a resurgence of interest. One of our correspondents, mm-hmm. Mary Julia Koch, is writing a story on this now yeah. of sort of the trad
yeah.
young cool,
men,
young men.
Yeah.
So there's definitely that. But overall, you think of the church in America, it's sort of it's on the decline. There's no other way to put it overall. And so that there's something interesting there about, is this the church's effort to kind of, you know, make a last stand here, or somehow thinking to revitalize the American Catholic Church? But you know, America's always been a Protestant country.
Mm-hmm.
It's not really a Catholic country in the
yeah.
way that that Europe is.
Yeah, no, that's true. And I guess we think about this politically and in terms of what's good for the church. I wonder if there's some space in my brain to just say maybe they picked, I don't know anything about him mm-hmm. personally and his religious beliefs, but maybe they picked somebody who's best for the actual church
yeah.
and the faith, and maybe they're looking inward instead of outward. Probably not,
yeah.
but I'd like to think so.
I think that's a good a great qualification, Rebecca. Right? I mean, for Catholics, the choice of a pope is a divinely ordained thing. It's
yeah.
the Holy Spirit selects them through this very human process. So we just
yeah.
sort of want to respect that. And you know, the church, as any, you know, corporation of billions of members and billions of dollars, has real issues that need to be addressed. Not only declining numbers, but declining amounts of men going into the priesthood is a huge issue.
Yes.
You know, schools are closing across America and elsewhere because they don't have enough students. And the church's finances are a mess. I mean, one of the things that Francis really failed to do was get its finances in
yeah.
order. So there's all kinds of sort of managerial or administrative tasks.
And also, I think there's a sense, and I think I feel this as a non-Catholic, that the Catholic Church generally has failed to promote its own Christian values
mm-hmm.
in political lanes and in other domains sufficiently. If I were a Catholic, I would want to see more of my clergy coming out and speaking up in defense of Christians who are being slaughtered in Africa. And I want them to speak more about the pro-life issues and, mm-hmm. and not sort of shy away from that politically. And so I think I don't know, again, the nature of this man's beliefs or his view of what he wants to accomplish, but it feels like maybe that might have been on the minds of the Catholic Church. Maybe that their numbers are shrinking because they've come to represent less of their mm-hmm. own Catholic nature. They've pushed that out into the world maybe less than mm-hmm. they used to, I think. And so mm-hmm. I don't know. But
yeah.
I want to get to the Holy Spirit, which
yeah.
you just said, because that for me watching the conclave was like my big takeaway. It was mentioned several times, and they all those cardinals who assembled in that room and sequester away are praying. They are not sitting there debating in that room. They've already had their debates.
Right.
They're there simply to pray and to vote. And the entire time they are waiting for the Holy Spirit to kind of guide them and tell them who to vote for. And in front of that glorious Michelangelo.
Two below and in front of Michelangelo.
Right? And just, if anything, it would put the Holy Spirit in a Jewish girl like me, it would be those frescoes. They're breathtaking, actually. And so the whole majesty and beauty of the actual setting and the seriousness and ritual of it all just spoke to the weight of it, such that even a non-Christian could be moved by the entire thing and feel the weight of that moment. And so maybe that's why I look at this new pope and hope that he is there to lead the church and its religious teachings before he's there to consider all the political implications of his work.
Yeah, no, that's very well said. And the aesthetics and the sort of just the beauty of it all is, you know, I said, I think last week, that the church and the English monarchy are really the two institutions that, and the monarchy less and less, retain that sense of grandeur and mystery and opulence in a way. I think on that point of being a spokesman, I think that's also part of his age, right? Francis was old. And Benedict was ancient. And I think, you know, maybe some of the doctrinal confusion or the sense of a muddled message had to do with not having a strong voice.
Right.
And now, you know, 69 in today's world is really young.
Yes.
Right. And so he'll have that opportunity.
Yeah. We cannot mention the Trump connection to the Vatican itself and all the gold and the ornate.
Yeah.
It just feels like Trump was in their ear saying, you know, maybe he did a backroom deal, like make an American pope and, you know, I'll help you renovate or something. But it's just, it all feels
Trump
so Trumpian.
St. Peter's, yeah.
Okay.
Great, okay. So we're making it make sense.
Okay. This is not this past week. It happened maybe a week and a half ago, but President Trump signed an executive order eliminating the disparate impact doctrine from federal agencies. And disparate impact was sort of embedded. You'll tell us more about the legal history and its import, but it was sort of embedded in 1964 Civil Rights Law, sort of designed to say that there were especially in employment sort of situations, there were ways in which certain groups of people were being discriminated against that was not intentional and direct, but was sort of the consequence of some other policy. And so one of the primary examples that people give of the disparate impact doctrine is sort of employers would ask if anybody had been convicted of a crime when they were applying for a job. And so the disparate impact defenders said, well, a lot of black and brown people would be disproportionately impacted by that rule because they are disproportionately incarcerated and therefore they wouldn't be able to apply for jobs. Mm-hmm. So employers stopped asking that question. That's just one example. There are many of them having to do with all kinds of protected classes under civil rights law. So Trump said enough with that, because really what we're talking about is equity. The idea is that the outcome has to be the same for all groups. That is what equity is. It's the E and the DEI. And he wants none of it, nor do I. I think this was the reason we're talking about it is because I think this might have been one of the most important things he will have done as president, and it's one of the least talked about. And so I wanted to get your perspective on the law itself, and then what do you think the impact of this EO will be?
Yeah, it's really a meaty subject. I think it's important to remember that when this first started, both in the executive branch as executive policy and almost more importantly in the courts, right, when called on to review, is this law discriminatory? The question was, how do you evaluate that? Do you evaluate it based on the intent or on the impact? Mm-hmm. You know, is it the inputs or is it the outputs? I think there were good reasons initially to think about impact, right? Especially before Jim Crow, even in the 50s and after Jim Crow, I'm sorry, in the 50s, really in the post-Civil War, until the Civil Rights Act, that 100 years, there were laws that were written to be ostensibly neutral, but to be discriminatory. In all kinds of devious ways, you know, so whether it was excluding blacks and Jews from housing or employment, you'd look at the numbers and it would be, you know, no minority has been hired for this job out of 10,000 applicants or something.
Or even if the law wasn't explicit, right? If it wasn't even intentional, you know, there were just there were workarounds and people could find ways. So they were starting to measure the outputs, as you say.
And so I think that, you know, that seems reasonable as far as it goes. The problem is, you know, that regime is still in that sort of disparate impact is still being used and, in fact, was turbocharged under the Biden administration, where, you know, sort of equity and equality of outcome, not opportunity, just to in a kind of quick and dirty way, was made the governing kind of North Star of how the federal government sort of operated. And there are plenty of reasons to be suspicious of that. I mean, you know, the fairness is important, obviously, but merit is a part of fairness, right? Is the best way to think about a law just, you know, its outcome, or is it neutrality, right? Is neutrality the way to think about this? So we've gotten in a situation where, at least in many institutions, including the federal government, the racialization of everything, right, has meant that certainly in academia, where many jobs aren't even open to people who aren't of a certain race or gender or whatever. So I think I've said this before, I think on this program, I think this is where actually Trump is on some of his strongest political ground, is unwinding that effort.
Yes. And, you know, ultimately, I think the country
Because Americans don't like it.
Yeah,
Americans
they've come to understand that equity, disparate impact concerns are really discriminatory in nature. They have to be by definition, because you have to then look at all the outputs and all the people who are in your company and start putting in quotas for how many of this and how many of that.
It creates a racial regime. I think the bottom line is, you know, do you think that things are basically fair, right? Not perfect, but fair. And if you think that, disparate impact becomes a lot less compelling.
Right.
Right. It's more compelling, I think, if you think a system is rotten. Right. And some people do think the system is rotten, right? The kind of the sort of left, I mean, that's the argument. And so it has to be rebalanced. But I don't think that's where most Americans are.
No.
I think most Americans think it's actually gone too far the other way. And it also seems that the Supreme Court is migrating to that position. I mean, you know, Students for Fair Admissions versus Harvard, right? The kind of landmark case saying you can't use race in admissions. And that's another product of that 60s, 70s.
So I guess that begs the question, you know, how effective is an EO like this, right? Even in that decision, as you noted, the universities just found workarounds. They found other ways to get that information. Sure. There's always workarounds. I think it's important to have a declaration that this is not the standard by which we are going to conduct business. And I think that's very meaningful. But what are going to be the actual practical implications of this? And do we need to – well, I can't imagine that Congress is going to take this any further. But there'll be – will there be legal battles over this? Will it end up – will this end up in the Supreme Court? And what will it matter ultimately?
I mean, the first thing to say is that the federal government itself, as we know from DOGE and other things, is a huge employer, right? I mean, so even an executive order that covers federal hiring, firing, evaluation is sort of a big deal. Mm-hmm. The government's not as big as it used to be 120 days ago, but it's still pretty big. But I think a lot of this stuff, and maybe this is sort of just how the slant I come at, a lot of it isn't so much about, you know, practicality. It's more like opening up the space to say, hey, you know, in conversations, you know, I think things should be race neutral. You know, I just think everyone should get a fair shot. I think that had become unsayable in a lot of elite circles in the past.
Well, more than just the ability to say it, which is important. I mean, these things were actionable and people were threatening suits and suing you if you didn't have 6% this and 7% that. So it takes away some of that fear, which is critically important. But I mean, is it lasting? Is it going to last past this administration?
Well, that's always a big question. I think a couple things. One is you're right to say it's not just about what's sayable, but we've already seen impacts. I mean, we've always seen, you know, corporations denounce DEI, law firms denounce DEI, universities denounce DEI. And sure, you can say they're workarounds, but still the fact that they aren't explicitly touting it is a huge change. I think the question of what happens next really is up to the Democrats, right? At some point, Democrats are going to win back the presidency. And the question is, when that happens, will they have moved on from this kind of ideology?
Right.
And I'm not talking about civil rights in a general sense. I'm not talking about, you know, combating racism and where it exists. I'm talking about a specific kind of 2020-ish, really extreme obsessed in, right. with race.
No
and
signs
identity.
That they're doing that, right? No, Jasmine yeah. Crockett and Kamala Harris yeah. coming back out of the shadows yeah. and saying it was all misogyny and racism, and that's
yeah.
why I lost.
Yeah,
I
mean, and the question is that
doubling down
fly?
On it.
Is that going to fly?
Right.
You know, or do you have people who are willing to run and renounce that? I mean, it's going to take more than just not talking about it. It's going to require real renunciation.
Right.
And
can you think
know.
Of a single Democratic leader right now? I cannot. Who has openly said, no, I don't believe in that, and it's wrong for America?
Yeah.
I can't think of one.
Yeah, not so, yet. I mean, no, I can't. But I'll just come back, and I say this all the time, but I think it's true. You know, that ad during the campaign where, you know, Kamala is on tape talking about, you know, sex change operations for convicted illegal aliens,
mm-hmm.
you know, he's for you, she's for they, them, not to pick on they, but just the point is that was enormously politically costly.
That was everything all bunched into one.
Exactly.
In a perfect package for the Republicans.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay. Tipping point. Diddy and the Met Gala. No, the reason that we wanted to talk about this, or I did, is because they happened sort of in the same night, Monday mm-hmm. night in New York. The Diddy trial, the jury selection began on that Monday, and that night was the Met Gala big mm-hmm. event, and sort of just built for TV. The theme was Black men's tailoring and dandyism,
yeah. mm-hmm.
they called it. Which sort of harkened back to times of slavery when prized Black slave men were dressed up in beautiful clothes and sort of showed off as like almost like the Birkin bag of their day mm-hmm. by the owners, the people who owned the slaves. And so they were talking about men's tailoring and all these celebrities show up, and it's the big to-do in New York, and a lot of socialites want to be there. And no, I did not want to be there. I'm not a socialite, but I did not want to be there. And I just, you know, at the other end of town, you have probably the best dressed, you know, he's mm-hmm. in a jumpsuit, but at the time, one of the best dressed, most fashion forward Black male celebrities in America, you know, being held in a cell and sort of going through jurors who are going to judge him for being a serial rapist and drugging people and the Diddy parties and all that. And it just, the contrast is extraordinary. He would have been at the Met Gala
sure.
had he not been, you know,
sure. right.
arrested. And I think just ultimately for me, it just it exemplifies everything that's wrong with American culture, that those people in those silly outfits celebrating a sort of, I think, a silly theme that maybe harkens back to this DEI thing. They can't let it go. I'm not sure what Black tailoring is as opposed to white tailoring or Asian mm-hmm. tailoring or any other kind, but maybe I'm wrong on that. But the whole idea that that's the concentration, that's the focus, that's the thing we celebrate, and it's the suit that mattered and not the person inside the suit. Look at P.
Well
Diddy.
Said. Yeah.
It just yeah. tells me something about where our culture is headed. And so, you know, you want it to be like in Midtown. You didn't want to be uptown at the Met Gala that night, and you didn't want to be downtown.
Right.
The
well
courts.
Said. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that's really right. I think, you know, part of maybe a little bit of the salutary effect of culture feeling more fragmented is that these things don't really feel like they have the sort of sheen and shine that maybe they did, you know, 15, 20 years ago.
Right.
We'll talk about that a little bit with the Pulitzer, but these kind of elite markers, you know, I mean, I'm all for a fun, fancy night out. So
yeah.
I'm, you know, I think the Diddy thing is sort of interesting to me because sort of setting it with the Harvey Weinstein trial that's now going on. And, I don't really have a ton sort of brilliant to say about, except to say it wouldn't shock me actually if Weinstein is acquitted. And I think, you know, a lot of these kind of Me Too era sort of prosecutions or cases sort of look a little bit different now. I don't know the specific
yeah.
evidence, and it, you know, he'll die probably a sick man, probably in jail. I'm no defender of Harvey Weinstein's behavior, but, yeah, just the question of sort of what's prosecuted, what's not, what kind of claims are seen as credible, yeah. the stories we tell about.
Well, I think people. I can say this as a woman, and you probably couldn't, and I don't know if you agree, but I'm safer in saying it, that I didn't see a lot of evidence that Harvey Weinstein was guilty of, you know, drugging and raping people. He you know, leveraged his position, and I think a lot of the people who accused him of rape were consensual adults looking for jobs. So I don't worry about his getting. I wouldn't like to have dinner with him, but I don't think he was a rapist. Diddy is a different category.
For sure.
And I also just think, just to be sort of silly about it, like, look at the conclave, those flowing red robes, all the beauty we just talked about. And then you look at the Met Gala and the pictures of the insane outfits and the silliness and the, it's designed to be provocative and to be in your face. But there's something sad about a fashion event at the Met Gala not being beautiful, not being chic.
Yeah.
Gone are those days. We've lost so much in the culture that we don't even celebrate beauty anymore. We celebrate the shocking and the ugly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And this was that.
Yeah, it's well put. I mean, a lot of those, you know, some of the people are beautiful, but the you know, the things are conversation pieces.
They don't have a deep
sort of meaning
ugly.
To it.
Yeah. Okay. Well, yeah. I mean, you know, New York is a center of culture, I think, for the world, and I think we put on our worst display last Monday. Yeah. So let's try to do better.
Yeah.
You have a sun like fashion show.
I was just going to say, get out my red robe. Okay. Sunburns, I guess, right?
Time to sunburn,
It feels like this has gone so fast. We have so much to talk about this week.
I know.
I'll start off this time. And that's my sunburn is the Palestinian poet Musab Abu Toa, who was awarded the Pulitzer Prize for commentary. I just want to say, you know, there's no doubt that his experience has been harrowing. There's no doubt that he's lost members of his family. You know, I have lots of empathy on a human level for suffering. But the awarding of a Pulitzer Prize to someone who has said that Israel is animalistic, that anyone who cares about the hostages should have the blood of Palestinian children thrown on them, who is denied that hostages even existed, called them killers, accused Emily Damari, who was a hostage, of being a soldier, even though she wasn't. By the way, she's a lesbian woman. Is just despicable. It's despicable. It's equivalent to Holocaust denial, and it is a sign of real degradation that this person is celebrated, and the message it sends for what's noticed, what counts, and what matters is a deeply depressing one. Again, you know, no interest in sort of policing conversation. Rebecca and I talked a lot on this program. We're both, you know, in favor of the First Amendment. It's not about censoring, but nobody who has made these kind of comments about any other group, would even be in consideration.
Yeah.
And I think in the long run, allowing this kind of rhetoric and whitewashing it is actually ultimately fatal to the institutions that reward it, right? It's not really fatal to the Jews or to Israelis. It's fatal. It's more fatal to the Pulitzers.
Agreed. Yeah, I agree with that. I think I said to you sort of mockingly, but only half. You know, it's denigrating to the idea of getting a Pulitzer. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if a really thoughtful, serious writer after this would even want to hold one and be in the company. It's like getting the Nobel Peace Prize after Yasser Arafat.
Yeah.
It just doesn't feel like the same thing. Mm-hmm. Okay, my sunburn is back to Newark, New Jersey this week. And those of you who were paying attention, there were major delays and a lot of chaos going on at Newark when some wiring malfunctioned and the air traffic controllers could not communicate with planes in the air. They just completely lost touch with them for 90 seconds. And I think there are still problems till today, actually, as a result of it. And there are so many problems with that airport and with infrastructure generally around the country that have to be addressed. And Secretary Duffy is about to release a planner, maybe doing so right now as we speak, to address that larger problem. But the sunburn, it was just a la Airplane from 1980. Mm-hmm. It was almost comedic that the union for the air traffic controllers came out shortly thereafter and said that these they had a shortage of air traffic controllers because they had to take a break because they were so stressed out, traumatized from the 90 seconds of disruption and chaos. And it was probably very stressful, 90 seconds. But they are on leave now for potentially up to 45 days for that 90 seconds.
That's a lot of seconds.
Stress. That's a lot of trauma.
I don't know the math in my head, but how many seconds are in 45 days?
What is that
days,
like, so. You know, for every 2 days you get like a it's just you know, this is sort of like that snowflakey. Are they all college kids at Columbia? Like, did they just, you know, did someone say something that hurt their feelings and now they don't have to take a test? It's now translated over to our air traffic controllers that if you have a hard minute and a half, you get time off to sort of recover yourself. Probably the pilots had a harder 90 seconds. I wonder if they're getting like a year off from their jobs. So my sunburn is to the union that is treating our air traffic controllers like children, and I hope they're not because they are controlling the airspace that we fly in.
Yeah, knock on wood for that. And just before we go, we didn't get to it this week, but Columbia, another disgrace last night, the library being taken over.
But we didn't do it because it sort of feels like, you know, same old, same old. Do we even need to say it? We sort of expect it at this point. Yeah, there's a lot we didn't get to. India and Pakistan on the verge of nuclear war, potentially.
No big deal. Right,
just a small minor incident.
Hope we're still here next week.
Yes, if we are, we promise to talk about that.
Yeah. Okay. Take care. Thanks,
Bye.
Rebecca.